All right, so we are after the midterm, so it's through that and don't have to worry about another test until the final, the very end here. So the midterm scores should be able to find them in your grade book. I think that they've fixed lockdown so that you should be able to view your stage one answers without having to go through lockdown again. Certainly be able to view your stage two, but then if you go to the midterm module, then there is an annotated solution set that I just printed out, sort of a PDF of one with the right answers, and then I've made annotations for ones that might require like other reasoning about that may not be completely clear by just the seeing the correct answer. So check out that. If you have any other questions about the midterm answers, then just let me or the TAs know afterwards. So can come to office hours or send an email with questions. All those things will work. But overall, I was happy with the scores. The distribution was about centered where I wanted it to be. I was really happy with the improvement from stage one to stage two. Usually by when I look at the stage two results, that kind of tells me what misconceptions get automatically fixed just by naturally, and then what things are still the things that are still difficult in stage two. That gives me a lot of good feedback for future iterations. So, thanks for doing all of that and nice work. I thought it was decent distribution there. So good job there. Looking forward, we've got reading assignments and Canvas exercises moving forward. As I've mentioned, I've added because there are a couple of different animal behavior talks this semester. I run a seminar, an animal behavior seminar. We've got two talks, one from Amelia Martins, a sort of a very prestigious animal behavior researcher right now, who works on things like fish as well as lizards, so Scolopteris lizards, as well as little, I think, zebra danio fish. And so they're not. Yeah, well, so and so she works with different aspects often of signaling. And so she was one of the first ones who built robot lizards that did push-ups in order to signal to other lizards to see what aspects of the push-up signal where they were responding to. And she also does work with color signaling and fish. And she's going to be talking about that highly relevant talk. And then Clive Wynn, who's actually from the Department of Psychology, he studies dogs and he studies dogs and whether they have significantly diverged from wolves and whether that's genetic or environmental, so G by E sort of stuff. And it has a lot of interesting opinions about like the buttons you hear about dogs pushing and all that. He sort of has a lot of interesting things that I'm sure have a very entertaining talk. So I highly recommend those two. I also mentioned that they're The Evolution of Social Complexity, which is run out of our School of Human Evolution and Social Change and the Institute of Human Origins, is more human focused, but they take a comparative approach. And so they talk about primates a lot. They talk about the evolution of social complexity in humans and the hows and the whys of that. So those are all very relevant too. So I put a list of those up there. And so with that, I've got that one extra credit assignment that I was either going to make it another ARE and then add in do a drop three instead of a drop two, but decided to try just making it an extra credit ARE instead. So at the moment, given that we've only had four AREs and you drop two, if you do that extra credit assignment, you've got like 150% in that category. But as that'll get diluted as we get more AREs toward the end of the semester. But for now, it'll give you the big boost to your estimated grade. So that's an option there. But unfortunately, I did get a submission that was submitted for a talk that hasn't happened yet. And so that's why I had to go back and redo the exercise so that you have to take selfies now to prove that you were there. So there's one of the questions, just if it's not clear, either you could be watching it remotely and you could be doing this with the screen in front of you, or if you're in a lecture hall like this, as you know, if you come early enough, there should be a title slide. And so it's just saying like, I want you to just take a selfie with the title slide over your shoulder, showing you are there. And then at the end of the talk, not a selfie, just take a picture of the end slide. And then you upload those two images to that in there. And that's just there to sort of, it goes along with, costly signals, honest signals. Like, if you make it more difficult to submit the assignment, So it's more costly to submit the assignment. It's a more reliable signal to me that you attended the talk. So it's kind of the theory behind that. But that's out there. That's an opportunity for you, that extra credit. Otherwise, the other thing to worry about is the final project groups. So it says 2 weeks. It's really more like a week and a half. I think it's due a week from Friday. So the idea here is you have this final project. You have to have 4-person groups. It's possible that there will be 3 based on numbers, but I want everybody to try for 4 initially, and then 3 is just going to be in order for me to make things work at the end. I might have to generate some 3-person groups. So, where do you, how do you form those? So there's a spreadsheet in the project module. There's a Google Sheets spreadsheet that's kind of a clearinghouse where if you have a hard time, finding people to join your group, you can put your name in there saying you're either looking for a team, or if you've got a team looking for a member, you can put that in there too. And then go back to it and then try to make those matches. So go back and return and see, oh, are there any teams now that I could join? And then once you've joined, if you can, it's nice to remove your name from that just to make it clear to everyone else. That's one way to do it. Feel free to post on Slack or the discussion boards. Ultimately, after Friday of next week, if I see that there's still people that aren't matched, I'll have to force groups to be made. And it's just a lot nicer if the groups were kind of formed organically rather than me arbitrarily putting members together. So that is the most immediate thing. And then about 2 weeks after that, you submit a very short submission of what your groups decided is going to be your organism and your kind of justifying context for this. So remember, the project here is you're supposed to, the ultimate deliverable will be a presentation that you'll upload to Canvas, so you won't be presenting in class, where you're it's kind of based on the last chapter of the textbook, which brings together conservation biology and animal behavior. And so the idea is you say, in the greater Phoenix area, where is there an organism whose behavior or who maybe anthropogenic causes might be interfacing hypothetically with the behavior of this animal that may or may not lead to changes that are biologically relevant, changes in distribution, changes in fitness, all sorts of things that, or just mechanistic changes, changes in how things work, and so on. So the idea is that it's going to be a practice on identifying possible patterns, identifying causal questions, coming up with a hypothesis, and coming up with a proposed experiment. You're not going to do the experiment. It's more like if you were proposing it, then to a funder, and if a funder then gave you the funding, then you could go out and do the experiment. So the sky's the limit on what you could propose because you're not actually going to do the experiment. So we're going to work in that in stages. And so the first stage is just identifying, like you're going to say that, well, I'm going to work with these grackles that are all over campus. And why these grackles? Well, I noticed that they aggregate more. They seem to aggregate more in certain areas than other areas. And I am interested in understanding the whys behind that and, and the greater implications. And so, that context of like grackles near the airport or something like that, like trying to understand why you chose that animal and what's the rough background context for why that animal might be interesting to investigate from a conservation biology perspective. So that is the general idea there. Any questions? Okay. All right. So then we are now moving on. So we had the first 4 sections are really the foundations of animal behavior. Post midterm, now we're trying to get into sort of more in-depth, detailed dives into ways in which we can apply those foundations and think about the specific problems that animals have to solve. And so the first one we're going to talk about here is movement, navigation, and everything that relates to that. And so I bring back the fiddler crab here. You see these fiddler crabs, these big males got their big claws here. But I'm not, for the moment, talking about their social signaling. So if you look at all of these different crabs, so some species of fiddler crabs, they build these turrets right next to their burrows. So that's what is going on there. You see these turrets. Other species don't build those turrets. But if you look across here, you see, different nest structures. You see different crabs. But do you notice anything in common about the position of these crabs relative to their burrows? What's the interesting pattern? Yeah, so that is definitely a part of it. The big claw is always facing away from the burrow. And so by extension, then the body is always lined up toward the burrow. So if you watch fiddler crabs move, then they will tend to, if that's my burrow and I'm a fiddler crab, and so crabs, they can walk forward and backward, they tend to walk sideways. And so, especially if they're walking slowly, they'll walk forwards and backwards. So the long axis of their body is this way, the burrow's there. As they move around, they will keep one side of them always facing their burrow and the other side out. And so that's just a feature that is pretty much that is in common with a lot of these fiddler crabs. And so what, it's a, like here's a video of that. I think in a second we'll transition to one that this one's burrow is actually over here somewhere, but we can only see it like in the beginning, like right there. So you can see it's lined up with its burrow. And the second we transition, and we can see there's one that is lined up to its burrow there. And you see it got spooked out and it kind of ran back towards its burrow there. And so that's going to be, if we see this pattern, this consistent pattern that these crabs are always keeping the burrow there, as an animal behaviorist, that should spark something in us. That should cause us to start asking causal questions. Why are they doing that? What is the adaptive value of that? And how the heck is that happening? How are they managing to keep track of where their burrow is as they're moving around? Those are two examples of causal questions that we might be interested in. And so people have studied this. So generally what happens when a fiddler crab leaves their burrow is they move in this kind of winding, circuitous path up to a particular point. And during that path, they're always keeping a portion of their body facing the burrow. So at any, along this path, you always see one edge of the crab facing the burrow. Just that's the pattern that we notice. So you get to the end here, crab facing the burrow. And then you get some scary grackle that comes by that is what just wants to we'll get to foraging later, but wants to eat this crab. And so this predator, and this prey, now the prey has this escape response. And so what the prey can then do is have a quick return to safety. And so one of the nice things about keeping your body oriented towards your burrow is you already always have a straight line escape path. So as long as you know how far to run, you can then run and then get quickly back to your burrow. You don't have to reorient yourself or anything. You immediately can spring back to that. So it's thought that that is one of the main reasons that they keep the long axis, their fast axis oriented towards their burrow, because it makes it so that when the predators show up, then they can quickly get back to that burrow. They don't have to orient around or anything like that. It also helps that, and this is a totally separate thing, they've got these eye stalks that are up here, and these eye stalks give them nearly 360-degree vision. So they've got these eyes that are up there. Think about the umwelt of the crab. And so they can keep their body oriented a particular way. You and I, we often have to orient so that, because if we're vigilant, we have to orient our head so that we can see the thing that we are worried about. But that may then affect our escape routes. So, there's always the movie where somebody is, in the house with the ghost or whatever in it, and they're always looking the wrong way and they're backing up. And of course, they back into the thing that they're trying to prevent themselves from encountering. The fiddler crabs don't have to worry about that. And, they even keep their eye stalks always vertical relative to gravity, even if they're going up a hill or whatever, they're always lined up with gravity. So, they've got this patrol area up here, and then they can then have this quick escape path. So there are a lot of then questions we can ask about it and experiments that we can run to try to understand what's going on with this crab. So one of the so Yeah, all right. So homing, that's a term I guess I should introduce now. So this crab we say is homing, that is movement with the goal of reaching a known resource, usually like a burrow, a shelter, that's used as a central place within the animal's home range. Homing, home. It's movement toward your safe spot, your refuge, your central refuge, not any refuge. So you're homing onto that central place. That's what the crab's doing. So we can ask questions about how it maintains this angle. And then also, how does it know how far to run? When does it, so does it just, because this, it's not always going to be right. So it might miss its burrow and then it needs to start searching for its burrow. So at what point does it go from a straight line run to a search? So people have studied this. And so orientation, that's the other thing here that, so sorry, I forgot that I had both of these in here. Orientation, that's movement in a given direction, not necessarily a location. So homing, you're moving towards your home. Orientation, you just have an orientation. So they orient their body and it happens to be oriented toward their home, but orientation is just movement, directional movement. So the question here is, how do they know when to stop moving in a directional movement and start searching? And so what researchers have done is they've basically put a bunch of sandpaper on top of sand and then let the crab wander until it hits the sandpaper. And then at that point, they use little robots or strings or something to very, very, very slowly shift the crab on its sandpaper over so that now it's not at the end here, but just really, really slowly as to hopefully not get to the point where whatever sensory mechanisms the crab is using to tell that it's oriented towards its home position, hopefully this is so gentle that it doesn't notice. That's the idea here. And if that's the case, then the thought is that if you scare the crab in this new position, then what's going to happen to the crab? It's going to run back to its virtual burrow, which has now been shifted over. So you shifted the crab over by this distance. So it now is, if it didn't update what was going on, like if it doesn't have a mechanism to update its map of where its burrow is, if it's all relative to the crab itself, and now you've shifted the crab over, then it should think that its burrow is here and not here. And so what happens then when you scare the crab, our prediction will be that it will run to around this location and then start searching, as opposed to running to this location. So if it was looking for its burrow visually, then this trick would have worked because it would still see its burrow. But if it's instead using some internal cues, then in that case, it'll run to where the burrow should be based on those internal cues and not find it, and then it'll go into a search pattern. And it turns out that's actually what happens with these fiddler crabs. And so I'll show a sample of this in a second here, but this phenomenon is the known as path integration. So it's this idea that rather than using visual cues, rather than saying, I'm not going to keep track of where I'm walking, because if I need to know where the exit is, I'm just going to look for that exit sign. So I don't have to know that when I walked in, I walked so many steps forward and over and so on, because I know that at any point, if I need to exit the room, I just look for an exit sign, I go. That's not path integration. If I was blindfolded, then I might, in order to know how to get out of the room, I might need to keep track of, oh, I did six steps forward, two steps to the left, and then I could reverse that in order to get back to back to my area. So that's what we notice is path integration. It's integrating, it's summing up all of the steps in order to keep track of where you are versus where you started. And so this is a hypothesis that maybe this crab is using path integration. And if it's using path integration, then when we scare it, then we would expect it to run in a linear pattern back to here. And then once it hits here, then start searching. And that's what fiddler crabs do. So fiddler crabs are one of the major model systems for studying path integration. They do path integration much better than we do, for example. We're highly visual. If you blindfold us and ask us to do this, people end up like they're nowhere near this disc. They're just very bad at it. Fiddler crabs are very good at it. And so then there's a lot of questions on how they're doing that. What are the mechanisms underlying their path integration? All right, so that's what I'm setting up here. Now, I also want to bring up this search. So there's this circuitous path and this circuitous path. This is both of these I'm going to bin under search. So this is movement to find a goal. It's random movement, pattern movement, or contingent on real-time information, but it's the idea that you're looking to find something. So on the outward path, they're looking to find food. They're searching for food. On the inward path, they know their burrow should be there, but it's not. So then they're searching for the burrow. So that random movement, it's not necessarily random, but in this case, random movement, we're binning under search. So we have orientation or oriented movement, just moving in a straight line, search movement when we're moving around trying to find something. All right, so any questions about this setup? The idea of finding fiddler crabs and path integration. Like we'll see, there's other animals that are also studied for their path integration. Fiddler crabs are just particularly good at it. Okay, so that's kind of the breakdown here that we've got. Our search here, you can have random search, and then you can also then have search for something specific. So we've got search, random movement cannot be predicted, so that's our searching outward, and then directional movements, movements oriented with respect to the surrounding environment. So once the crab gets the hint that it's near its burrow, it stops the random movements and then it moves directionally towards something. So there's oriented movement, which is just I'm moving in a line, and then there's directional movement, I'm moving towards something. So that's the kind of nuance there from, or the crab orients its body in a direction, but then here the crab sees the burrow and it moves toward the burrow. That's directional. So orientation versus direction. Okay. There are other search patterns you see animals do. Random search is very common, but spiral search is also common. So we mentioned tandem running ants. So those ants, there's a leader and a follower. Remember, the leader walks a few steps and it waits for the follower to touch her on the rear end before she walks a few other steps. While before that happens, you can pluck the leader away and the follower will walk a little bit. And then when the leader isn't there, the followers will start walking in spiral circles in order to try to look for this leader. And if she eventually, after a certain amount of time, it's like 10 seconds on average, but it's pretty close to that, then she'll stop the spiral search and then just go home. And what's interesting is if you do the opposite, where you pluck the follower away, the leader will stand there and wait to be touched for about 10 seconds. So it's been calibrated between the two that if you don't get any contact within 10 seconds, just give up on the tandem run. So, but spiral search, that's how, you see them do that spiral search. That's pretty common. And then there's variations on the spiral search. There's these kind of square searches. A lot of times these might be following edges. And then, you can have these kind of lawnmower patterns. So a lot of different ways that you could search. All right, but search, it's just potentially random, but it's the idea here is you're filling a space, looking for something in that space. You're trying to find all the food in the space, or you're trying to find your burrow and you don't know where it is. Search. Okay. So when we talk about search, then we can talk about modulations in search patterns. And this particular pattern is something we call levee flight. So this is really common in like birds, where there's areas where they want to do tight searches, but then there's long areas in between where they might be looking for these areas, so they're not actually looking into the fine grain details. And so a levee flight or a levee walk is these searches where you kind of switch back and forth between these long, almost straight paths, and then tight, short paths in your searching, and then you switch back to another long, straight path. So when you hear people talk about levee flights, that's the idea, is that it's a switching between, it's like you're looking for it might be that an animal, it doesn't have to be flying, even though it's called levee flight. It could be an animal moving through the forest, and then it sees a patch of bushes, and then it moves around and looks through that patch of bush really tightly, and then eventually it gives up, and then it does another long movement until another patch of bushes, and then it looks tightly around that. So that's referred to as a levee flight. And it turns out that you can show mathematically this is actually a very efficient way to search for things. It sort of balances exploration and exploitation in a nice way. You don't spend all your time searching in a fine-grained area or with fine-grained search, but you also, don't spend all your time just looking for the big stuff that you can only catch when you're kind of moving around quickly. And so a lot of animals use this levee flight, or thought to at least use these levee flights, because they're a very efficient way to search. So levee flights. Is that clear what I mean by levee flights? This idea that it's this switching back and forth between coarse-grained and fine-grained, long sort of long paths where you don't stop, and then short paths where you've got lots of turns. So it's like there's almost no turns, and then there's lots and lots of turns. Okay. All right. And then so when we're talking about turning behavior, then there are different categories we can think of for turning. So this kinesis, or kinesis for plural, is a change in speed or movement without orientation to a stimulus source. So when we can talk about like that, at a particular point, an animal just slows down, speeds up, or turns, but it's not turning towards something. It's not trying to stay near something. It's just the stimulus changed and the animal changed its turning behavior. So you can have different categories of that. So you can have clinokinesis. So that's the turning one. So turning movement that changes its rate as the stimulus strength changes. And so if you're in a wind tunnel, then you can find that if there's a high concentration of the odor, so you release the animal here, the odor is here. So you have a high concentration of the odor. Here, they don't turn very much. They're sort of long, straight paths. But then over here, they start turning a lot. And so that is, I think this next one asks, is this clino or ortho? That's what we refer to as kind of clinokinesis, is that the turning rate is changing, versus orthokinesis, where in this case, it's straight line motion undirected with respect to a stimulus source. So this is the classic cockroaches scattering in light. You turn them on and they just run in any direction. They run straight in any direction. So they're not changing their turning. They were moving around slowly, and then suddenly they just pick an orientation and then they run. So that's orthokinesis. It's like, sounds like orthogonal, which is kind of like perpendicular. So it's like a straight line, ortho. And so whereas clino, then you're constantly turning, but maybe you're turning more often. So those are kineses. So they're not directed toward a stimulus source. They're just generic changes in your turning behavior or your speed because you've been stimulated. It's almost like a releaser of this turning change or speed change. Now we can build on that though, and contrast that with taxis or taxis. So a taxis is a change in direction or movement that are oriented toward the stimulus source. So you can combine a kinesis with an orientation to produce a taxis. And so if you not only know that the stimulus has changed, but you can actually tell that, oh, it's stronger there and weaker there, I'm going to turn toward the stronger, then that goes from being a kinesis to being a taxis. So that way you've got movement that is actually toward a stimulus or away from a stimulus, but the stimulus is the compass. The stimulus is setting up the direction. That's the difference between a kinesis and a taxis. And so there are different types of those, similar prefixes here, clinotaxis. So this is turning that is oriented to a stimulus. So like this moth, if it can somehow detect that there's a higher concentration this way, then it'll tend to turn here. There's tropotaxis. This is movement to a point between two stimuli. So if you have two light sources and an animal goes in between or goes toward the middle of them, then that's like a tropotaxis. And then there's telotaxis, Movement to one of two presented stimuli, typically either toward a larger or toward a smaller, but the idea is it's almost like a comparison. And so you can say, I've got a bright light and a dim light. And so if you have positive telataxis, then you're moving towards the bright light. But if you have negative telataxis, you're moving toward the dim light. But it is toward a stimulus. So we can have toward stimulus, but we also have away from stimulus. And we can name these based on the type of stimulus too. So that's my next slide advancement is going to replace this with some of these names. So, but before that, I just want to make sure, is it clear what I mean by the difference between taxis and kinesis? And how you can combine kinesis with orientation to get a taxis. All right, so the different taxis. And so you'll see them prefixed like anemotaxis. So some ants, for example, they come out of their burrow, or they come out of their nest, and they walk into the wind. So that is a wind-based taxis. So wherever the wind is blowing, then they walk that way. And you could hypothesize on why that's a good thing to do. Like if there's seed harvester ants, maybe the seeds will be blowing in from that direction. And so you walk up that, or maybe they just all need to agree on a direction. And the wind is a very large cue that allows them, it's easy to agree on that. So that's a anemotaxis, it's wind-based. There's chemotaxis, and so you've got a chemical gradient, just like in that moth example. Gravitational taxis, geotaxis, so you're moving down into the earth or away from it. Magnetotaxis, if you have the ability to sense magnetic fields. Photo, you're moving, you're sensitive to the light. Or almost the opposite of photo, scoto. Sometimes this is spelled with a C. The neurobiologists like to spell this as SCOTO. Behavioral ecologists like to spell it as KOTO. It's a Latin versus Greek thing. Why the neurobiologists went, I think Latin, and why the behavioral ecologists went Greek, I don't know. But you just see K's and C's that are mixed. And so these two are interesting. They're related to this light and dark. We can put negative and positive in front of each one of these. So you can have positive phototaxis, and that means moving toward a light. But then you can have negative phototaxis, means that when you see that light, you move away from it. And then likewise, you can have positive scototaxis, meaning that you move toward dark, or negative scototaxis, where you move away from dark. And it seems like negative phototaxis should be the negative phototaxis should be the same as positive scototaxis, and very often they'll be similar. But the idea here is that it's about your sensitivity to the dark or to the light. So when a cockroach runs into a dark area, then it might be attracted to darker parts of the area. We don't view it as necessarily it running away from a light stimulus. It's actually kind of running toward a dark stimulus. And so there are cases where it's important to emphasize that it's a scototaxis and not a negative phototaxis. But very often, these two are almost two sides of the same coin. But that's the idea, is that you name the taxis, and then you say, is it positive or negative? Are you running towards it or away from it? Questions about any of that? Pretty clear. Just the terms we use to describe animal movements. Okay. All right. So, and then that brings us then, now that we've got taxis, now that we've got animals moving towards stimulus, then we build all that up and into the general ability to navigate. So, what's navigation? That's guided movement from one location to another, guided by lots of possible things, lots of possible stimuli or internal mechanisms. So they could be driven by a compass, landmarks, or other sensory information, but it's guided movement. So we refer to the fiddler crab as navigating home, or even navigating away from home. So it has a location it came from, it has a location it's going to, and it has to solve the challenges in order to get from point A to point B. That's navigation. And so, when we talk about navigation, then we say, well, then how does it figure out, what direction to go into, or the location of a stimulus? And so I've sort of suggested that with taxis, that there are ways to move towards stimuli. But then we have to say, well, what are those mechanisms? How do you actually figure out where a stimulus is? And triangulation is one of those ways that we do that. Let me see if I can get back to my other. Sorry, I think I double-clicked a few more times. All right, there we go. So triangulation, identifying the location of a stimulus by sampling it from at least two different locations. And so it's this idea that if you smell a chemical here, you don't know where it is until you smell it somewhere else as well. So if you smell the chemical here and then you move over here and you smell it, then if it smells weaker, it's probably in that direction. If it smells stronger, it's probably in that direction. And so that's generally referred to as triangulation. Now, there are different ways that animals can triangulate. They can do exactly what I just said. You can sample at two different locations, and you'll see animals do that. They'll move around, they'll maybe stand in place, and they'll turn this way, and they'll turn this way, and they'll end up, getting those two. And after they sort of switch back and forth, then they'll end up moving, and then they'll do that again. And so you can sample in two different regions of space at different times. That's sequential triangulation. Or you can do simultaneous triangulation, seeing a stimulus at two different locations at the same time. Two eyes, two nostrils, two antennae. So, we know the antennae are inverted nostrils. That's why they're kind of connected, like the eyes of the insect, and then the antennae are kind of coming out where your nose is. So you can think of it as inverted nostrils. It turns out that people have run experiments where they've outfitted probably undergraduates volunteering for research with soda straws up their nose. And if you put a soda straw up your nose and it's long enough and you put them far enough away from each other, it turns out that you can are much, much better at orienting to odors. And so you're much better at figuring out that, and your brain just it very quickly adapts to these soda straws, and you can then track odors much better than you can when it's just coming in your two nostrils here. So we have two nostrils. It's probably not for triangulation because they're so close together. There's all sorts of weird things that happen to your nostrils. Did you know you only breathe out of one nostril at a time? It's called the nasal cycle. And so every like 6 hours, the nostril switches. This is why if you have a cold, sometimes you're like for 6 hours you can't breathe, and then the other 6 hours you can. That's because you've got this, your brain is it constricts, it does blood flow, it constricts the hole at the top of your nostril, and it can constrict one and open the other and then go back and forth. And if you just happen to have all the snot on one side, then for 6 hours, then you just are stuck not being able to breathe, and then suddenly your nose flips, and then you can breathe again, and then it'll flip again and you can't breathe. So that's the nasal cycle. So there's a lot of crazy things that are going on inside your nose, and there's theories about, well, sometimes you need, maybe it's to keep from drying your nose out, but maybe your sensory system needs airflow or whatever. But I don't think the two nostrils are really helping with triangulation. But in insects, that's why their antennae stick way out there. They do think it helps with triangulation. With lizards with eyes on the side of their heads, that probably helps with triangulation. Certainly with our eyes, it helps with triangulation. It's you get a lot better depth perception when you have two eyes. You can train yourself to get some depth perception with only one eye available, but you get a more natural depth perception by comparing the images from your two eyes. So that's simultaneous triangulation. So you have two organs in simultaneous triangulation, you have two samples of time in sequential triangulation. Any questions about those two ideas? Two different ways of locating a stimulus. Okay. And then a general form of simultaneous triangulation, steropsis or stereopsis. So this is what I was saying, binocular vision. So that's just a case of simultaneous triangulation. But when you're talking about vision, it just has a special name. And that's your depth perception, your binocular vision. And so some animals combine these. So you can see that you've got this lizard's got these clearly separated visual fields, and that helps it. But because it doesn't have much overlap, it actually also benefits from it moving its head around. And so you can get this combination of using both of these together. And so, but then otherwise here, like ladybird larva, so this one's probably just using sequential. So you see them move and they stop, they kind of swoop around. I heard that over here, so I'm going to go to it. So, because my ears on the other opposite side of my head, and this one it was louder, so I went that way. So ladybird larvae, so you can see them, and they do these little swingy things back and forth, and then they move, and they do it again, they do it again. So it seems like they're orienting toward stimulus, but they have to sample first. So that's your sequential triangulation. So, and then like I was saying, lizards move their heads as well. So they've got these disconnected visual fields. It's probably actually benefits them to maybe look at this visual field with this eye sometimes too, so they can, combine the benefits of both. All right, so clear what we mean by triangulation and these two types of triangulation. So, these are just examples of like, people watch ladybird larvae and they noticed they had this pattern that they would stop and then they would do this sort of swinging thing and then they'd stop and do the swinging thing. And then it raised questions. What are they doing? Why are they doing that? And the why is it allows them to locate stimuli. The how, is they've it's exactly how far they switch in this particular direction. How often do they stop? Those sorts of things. Developmental questions, the fact that they're larvae, do the adults, do the beetles that emerge from this, do they continue to do that? Developmental questions. And then phylogenetic questions, do all ladybird larvae do this? So just things to think about. You see a pattern and you try to think of the four questions. That's what you should be doing when you think about your final project. Okay, and then another one of my favorite examples of path integration, these cataglyphous ants. So this is an example here where we're introducing this idea of allothetic information. This is information obtained from environmental stimuli, light, sound, odors, sun, the sky, and the stars. So this is one way you can navigate. So in the reading, you're going to read about a dung beetle that uses the stars for navigation. And so if you take away the stars, you take away its ability to navigate. So that's an easy experiment to run. But there are other animals that don't use external cues. And so they use internal cues, idiothetic information. So this is internal to the animal, memorized and continually updated. Path integration and homing are two examples of movement that use this information. So if I'm using that exit sign, that's allothetic. If I don't pay attention to the exit sign, but I count my steps, that count in my head, that's idiothetic information. It's information coming from inside the animal. So people who study cognition often also are interested in idiothetic information. So you wouldn't think path integration sounds like a very cognitive thing, but this is where you do see path integration literature overlap with cognitive literature, because this in itself is one of those internal mental states that you need in order to understand the animal's behavior. All right, questions about that distinction before I show this example of these cataglyphs? Okay. So this cataglyphus example is going to help us also introduce this idea of an odometer. So an odometer or odometry is any physical or mechanical device that allows measurement of the distance traveled. The odometer in your car tells you how far you've traveled on this trip since the car was purchased. It tells you the distance there. And so there are certain animals that have odometry mechanisms inside them that they apparently are sensitive to. So they're apparently estimating distance as they're moving. And that, if you notice these ants here, I just want to focus on this ant looks like it's buried in the ground. That's because someone cut off half their legs. This ant looks like it's really tall. That's because someone glued sticks to all of their legs. And this is the normal ant, the normal sized ant here. And so they were testing a hypothesis that these ants use an odometer based on their step count, that their ants were counting their steps. And if under that hypothesis, then if you manipulate the length of their legs in the middle of a trip, then if they're trying to path integrate, you're going to introduce path integration errors. So let's see what that looked like. Path integration and cataglyphous ants, these desert ants. These ants live Not in our desert. They live in the African desert where it is just barren. So there are no visual cues that can help them. And yet, and also it's so hot, they can't use lay pheromones. If you lay a pheromone, it evaporates immediately. And yet they are able to wander out like the fiddler crab, find food, and then run straight back home. So they still can do path integration very well. Not as good as fiddler crabs, but pretty good. So what they did is they did that manipulation that I just talked about there. They let ants go out and find some arthropod that's dead in the desert. And as the ant reaches the arthropod, they pick the ant up and they cut its legs off, or they glue new legs to it, or they leave it alone. They just pick it up and put it down as a control. And then they let it go and they watch where it goes back. And it picks up, and usually it's dead arthropod, and it walks back home. And then they see, at what point does it stop walking in a straight line and start searching for home, like the fiddler crab? And the cool thing that they find is that the normal ant basically stops right where home is. So it reaches home, it goes straight home, and it doesn't start searching. It just goes into its burrow, into its home, into its nest. The one that where they glued stilts to it actually passes home. And after it runs by home, then it starts searching. And it starts searching at a point that is predictable by how long you've added to their legs. And the one where they've cut the legs off and turn them into stumps, if that's their burrow and they started out over there, they run in a straight line distance and they stop early and they start searching early. So this appears like they're running out from their burrow, saying, "All right, I went 500 steps in this direction, so now I need to go 500 steps back." And so if you make a step longer or shorter, then you cause them to overshoot or undershoot. Any questions about that experiment? So if that's the case, what's a natural next experiment to run? So the claim was that they run out with normal legs, you manipulate their legs, and then they run back the wrong distances based on the manipulation. So what's another experiment that seems very natural that you could run next, now that you've got all these ants that have long legs or short legs? Yeah. Bingo, that's right. That's the that yeah, so that's exactly what they did. So when you let them, when you place them back home with their mutilated legs and then let them go out and forage again, then it turns out they're fine. So when they leave home with long legs, they'll go, they'll find a you know, a dead fly or something like that. They'll pick it up and they'll go exactly the right distance back home. And then likewise with short legs, they'll go, you know, to the fly or whatever, pick it up and go exactly the distance back home again. So this further reinforces. So this is an example of how one hypothesis can have two different predictions. So this was one experiment. Oh, this was one experiment here. And so under this experiment, the prediction of step counting was this. It matched the predictions here. Under this experiment, then the prediction would be this thing here. So we've run two experiments to test one hypothesis, which gives us further evidence that that hypothesis might be true. And this is a very common pattern because it's easy to reject a hypothesis. It's very hard to accept a hypothesis. You know, you can't accept, you know, you can't turn natural selection from a hypothesis into a theory without lots and lots of evidence that fails to reject it. And so here, this is consistent with predictions, but there might be another hypothesis that's consistent with these predictions. So then you run a different experiment, and if some reviewer comes up with another hypothesis, then that reviewer has to come up with an alternative hypothesis that agrees with both of these things. And that makes your argument much stronger because you know, if you can get a match in multiple experiments that has very different outcomes, but they all match your hypothesis, it gives you a lot of confidence that that hypothesis is likely what's going on. So just one wouldn't quite be enough, but two really firms it up. So questions about that experiment or what was done here, what the ants are doing? So like fiddler crabs, they'll do things like they'll run out And then while the fiddler crabs are out there, they'll inflate a hill quietly so the fiddler crab doesn't notice. And then when you scare it, it has to run back over the hill. If fiddler crabs were step counting, what would the prediction be if you inflate a hill on its return path?
Stuff before they get to that barrel.
Yeah, why? Right. So if you inflate a hill, then you're going to add distance for that fiddler crab in order to get home. And so if they're step counting, the fiddler crab should maybe stop on the top of the hill or they should stop short. But it turns out that fiddler crabs, whereas I think ants, that's actually what happens. I don't think they've got actually the way to kind of correct for the gravity here. Fiddler crabs do. So when you inflate the hill for a fiddler crab, when they run over that hill, they then come back and they stop exactly on their burrow. So, and we also know, like I was mentioning, the eye stalks of fiddler crabs, they always, this is a little bit like geotaxis, their eye stalks are always oriented away from gravity. So when they're on a hill turned 45 degrees, their eye stalks are turned this way, always up. So it's very clear that fiddler crabs have an awareness of gravity. We don't know if that awareness of gravity is due to the actual force being pulled down on them, or it's due to their proprioception that the front legs are bunched up more than the back legs. But whatever the mechanism is, they have a sense of gravity. And it appears like the fiddler crabs effectively can project their distance onto the horizontal plane. So when they go over a hill, they know that well, my step up the hill is actually less of a step in the horizontal plane, and they correct for that. And they then go back to the burrow. So, these are experiments you can do to test step counting. And fiddler crabs do a much more complicated step counting than I think the ants do. All right. Any other questions? All right. Well, those are sort of our basics of movement and navigation. So key things I want you to take away here, navigation and homing and path integration. Those are kind of really big ones there. The taxis and triangulation, I think those are sort of big things to take away too. And then allothetic and idiothetic information. So that idea that you can respond to external cues, allothetic, a map that everyone can agree on, or idiothetic information. Those are your internal cues based on history. So that's like a key thing. And again, it very much connects to cognition as well, that internal mental state that has to be maintained in the animal. Okay. So just as a reminder, solution sets out, assignments are there, plus that extra credit assignment. For those interested in honors contracts, I actually put together two case studies that would be nice outputs, example outputs of an honors contract, and then gave like 10 different animal model systems that if I had more time, I'd love to cover in class, but we just don't have time. And I had to select other things instead. But, but it would be great to have like more case studies or presentations that are on those systems. And I gave some examples of those. And then, a week from Friday, we need your four-person groups. So I can help you a little bit, but hopefully you'll self-organize. So let's get you your attendance credit. All right, so we'll do a short answer for this one. And the question is a directed movement toward gravity would be referred to as a what? If you were walking, if you were an animal that was moving, moving in the direction of gravity, so down where you tended to move downwards, if you're on a wall and you could move in any direction, but you tended to walk downwards, down to gravity, what would be a term that we would use to refer to that? So I'm looking for a prefix and a suffix, basically. So, what's the prefix for gravity or the earth? And what's the suffix for oriented movement toward a stimulus? And that's all I've got for you. So get out a little early today.